acting and this type of behavior, and it's not something that I need to like actually point out that, oh, there's something wrong with this. Like everyone knew before, it was clear, but now I'm having people ask like, what is wrong with that? Like, whoa. And then you dig deeper and deeper, you find that, oh my God, if this generation, if not this generation, the generation after might be in big trouble when it comes to the faith. And this is all over the world today. It doesn't even matter if you're in Pakistan or Iran even. It's still a threat now. The ideologies are being targeted. Yeah? So in a sense, what's happening around the world today with the people, the Shia of, for example, Nigeria, which may Allah protect them. What's happening to them is a bala, is a tragedy really. But which one is bigger? What did our hadiths teach us? That the tragedy of losing faith is bigger or losing your life is bigger? Well, Imam Hussein taught us losing faith is the worst thing, and that's why he's going to give his life so that others don't lose their faith. That's what's scaring me now. That before I would worry about our younger brothers and sisters, like, are they living up to the deen? Now you're getting these questions here and there, comments here and there, that the deen isn't even understood properly. So where does that put us? Where does that put us? We have to start educating ourselves a lot more and taking Islamic education a lot more serious. When I say Islamic education, not necessarily Islamic school or Sunday school. I'm talking about the 25-year-olds right now, the 30-year-olds right now even. Are we reading? Are we asking questions? Are we going around researching? If we're not, things are coming up and people are not finding answers. And before you know it, this guy's out, that guy's out. I have to hear about this guy marrying somebody that's out of the religion. That guy who was Shia has now turned Christian. How does that happen? So these are issues that are going on in the world today. That stuff is happening. The firm iman is there, they're losing their lives. Other places, no one's losing their life, but the iman is being lost. Yeah. Where does this start from? When are we supposed to start educating ourselves, solidifying this iman, getting things right? I think nowadays we need more of education. We need to add that. In addition to everything else that we have, it seems like this is very serious. So that's something I had in mind. I'm just sparking the conversation here and getting things going, you know, trying to get the ball rolling, inshallah. So that's some ideas that I had. I'm going to hand it over to Sheikh as well.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين Alhamdulillah, Sheikh Amin gave a very good introduction to tonight's discussion. I think there's two parts to it. The first part is talking about our faith, and that is a contemporary issue. And it's an issue that's facing us, not just in this part of the world, but now I'm seeing in other parts of the world as well. As I pointed out last night, that the issues of modernity, for example, are not just issues facing the Western world, they are now also facing the Eastern part of the world as well. And the second issue is the issue of oppression that our brothers and sisters are facing around the world as well. That's of great concern to us. I think the one thing that's common in between these two, if we're going to do something about either one of them, is to increase our understanding of the religion and to have the right understanding of the religion and to have a deeper understanding of the religion. Right? Not just having information about the religion or data about the religion, but actually having ma'rifah and understanding of our faith. Having a deeper philosophical understanding of our faith. For those of you who joined us in some of the lectures, you know, we say that one of the main reasons that today, for example, we're seeing a more materialistic view of the world and a less of a theistic view of the world, where God is in the presence, God is there, is not because of the advance in science. It's because there has not been an advance in our understanding of the religion, our understanding of philosophy, to match the advance that has happened in science. So I think a focus on understanding of the deen, tafaqquh of the deen, is really, really important in this day and age. That also then helps us when it comes to also helping those who are oppressed around the world. Right? Because we can have a very narrow understanding of the deen, or we can have a broader understanding of the deen. In a very narrow understanding of the deen is limited to rituals and fulfilling of rituals. And rituals are important. Rituals carry a strong message within them. Rituals carry strong values within them. But we shouldn't limit the understanding of the religion just to the rituals. I was talking to somebody yesterday, and I thought it was a good way of thinking about it, is Islam is layered. And when we talk about conveying Islam, it's actually about conveying all of the layers of Islam. The first layer and the most apparent layer is the layer of ahkam. But those ahkam are actually layered upon akhlaq. A certain set of values lead to certain practices. And those akhlaq are layered upon aqidah. Certain beliefs will lead to those values. And those aqa'id are also based upon a particular mantiq, a logic, a way of deciding between right and wrong, good and evil. So if you can stay with me, if we think of the mantiq and the aqidah as the operating system, and let's say we think of the akhlaq and the ahkam as the software, what we have done is we've transferred the software, but we haven't sometimes transferred the operating system. Are you getting what I'm saying? Yeah? We've not transferred the aqidah, the ma'rifah, the way of thought. And then you come to the next generation and you say, but you should pray like this, you should act like this, you should behave like this. It doesn't make sense to them because that particular software wasn't meant for his operating system. You've got to think about why has that happened and how do we deal with that. But in any case, they are layered like that. So we also have to develop a good understanding of the religion. The one point I'll make, and I'll end with it right now, is this idea that a religion is not limited to rituals, that we actually have to become a moral person. And we have to start also thinking about what are our other duties and responsibilities. Sometimes we don't think about that. And then the things that happen around the world, we don't think of that as our duty and responsibility. As long as I'm saying my prayers, I'm doing my fasting, I am giving my khums, for example, I have fulfilled my duty, right? And we limit Islam to that. And sometimes I find that the younger generation wants also a sense of purpose to come from Islam, a sense of movement to come from Islam, a sense of zeal to come from Islam. They want to see how Islam can change the world. They want to see how Islam can make the world a better place. Right? And we have to, of course, present that understanding of Islam as well. Right? So I'll give you an example. What happens when we only pass on the rituals, but we don't pass on a broader understanding of the deen? You know, the first imam has a beautiful hadith where he says, "Kun lil-zalimi khasma walil-madlumi auna." Right? Be an enemy to the oppressor and a helper to the oppressed over there. Okay? That's a duty that we have. Right? So you know that some people from Kufa had come to, I think it was Abdullah ibn Umar or Abdullah ibn Abbas, after the tragedy of Karbala. Right? And they came to him and they say to him that, we have a question for you. What is the kafara of a person, I think it was, who kills a fly in the state of ihram? He looked at them and said, like, you're a very strange people. You know, you went and killed the grandson of the Holy Prophet, you didn't worry about that. But killing a fly, for example, and asking what's the kafara for that, that's become a big deal for you. Now, it's right, they should have a sense of duty and responsibility towards the ahkam. But what about a sense of duty and responsibility towards justice? Right? Towards those who are being oppressed, for example. I think we need to also inculcate that understanding of Islam, which is very much a part of our traditions and a part of our ethos. So inshallah, I think I'll stop it at that and pass it on now. Who's moderating?
So the structure for this Q&A will be, we're going to pass around chits. And you can write out your questions and you can send them to the front. and we'll go ahead and read out the questions from those chats. So we are sending around a box with pens and papers in them. The girls have them too. So whoever has a question, once the chat is filled out, please send them forward and we can go ahead and take a look. Sure. Okay, so if anyone has a question that they want to ask. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Salah. Just a quick question. So on strengthening the Aqaid or even develop, like forming it, what are some practical ways that the youth can kind of attempt this or address this issue?
All right, bismillah. So, look, it's the 21st century, it's 2019. When I left for Qom, it was 1999. So I sometimes feel that it's still 1999. But then I look in the mirror. So, look, there's a lot of things going on now. There's a responsibility I think the scholars have, and a responsibility that the people out there have that are, you know, serious about learning more, okay? The scholars, their responsibility, well, first of all, the people who go to Qom, their responsibility is to study well before coming back. That is itself something we can talk about later, maybe. People who go to Qom, they have to study well before coming back. And then, when they come and they're leading a community, they need to start these types of classes, right? And not just keep it to the rituals, as Maulana said, or keep it to the main programs that we have. The main programs are going to always be there. They should be there. There's no doubt about that. But there has to be more. There has to be more. There has to be classes. That's their part, their job. And then the job of the people is to show up to those. All right? So I've done this before in other places, in other centers, where we would have classes. You'll have classes that you know people won't find anywhere else, but they might not take it very seriously. You know, I've noticed this. It's unfortunate. Or like there's stuff online these days. There's a lot of stuff. Personally, I'm trying to do as much of this educational stuff that I can online and even in our locality where we live and even nationally, okay? And others are also doing the same thing as well. And I've noticed personally that people don't show up sometimes, you know? So it takes work from both sides. That's like, I can't think of anything else. There is no USB connection that I can like connect to your head and get the knowledge across that whatever I have to share with you. This has to happen, you know, and it has to be regular. And I know they also do that kind of stuff here too, mashallah. Out of that comes questions. That scholar has to go research those questions and come up with an answer. So he'll grow more as well, or she'll grow more as well. And then the discussion goes on and on. I'm aware of certain things that are going on, even in Toronto right now, mashallah, it's good stuff. Are people actually after it or not? That's another story that sometimes, we might get a little lazy. I know everyone's busy, but these younger guys that I'm seeing here, mashallah, like if you guys can like get involved in these things, they're out there nowadays, online. And I don't know, there's this thing about face-to-face versus online. People just don't take online stuff too serious sometimes. But no, the knowledge is there. Right now I'm here. If I want to listen to classes in Qom, they're uploaded to either Telegram or they're online on some website. The Maraja's darses are online. Like, what more could you ask for, really? You're sipping on your timmies, but you're having your dars of kharij. What more could you ask for, you know what I'm saying? What about us? Is that what you do?
I think one thing is we shouldn't be afraid of asking questions, and we shouldn't even be afraid of doubt. When doubt comes into our mind, it's not the end of the world. And I love a quote from the late Shahid Mutahhari. He says, there's no problem walking in the valley of doubt. Right? The problem is when you remain in the valley of doubt. It's only by walking in the valley of doubt that you're going to reach the peak of yaqeen. You know, we have a hadith even from the Holy Prophet where somebody came with him worried with doubt. The Prophet said, don't worry, that is part of faith. When you ask the questions, now you're wanting to find a reasonable answer, a rational answer to that question. So number one, not being afraid of having doubts. But number two, then asking questions. I think the asking part is really, really important. I'm finding in today's society that a lot of our youth... All right. Is that a sign from God? Okay. when they come across issues that they face, instead of asking the scholars or asking the right scholars, they make up their mind by themselves and they say, ah, that makes sense or that doesn't make sense. I had a young man who, you know, spent some time with us. I'd see him regularly. And then one day he met me and he started spewing off certain things that kind of shocked me. And I said, but like 2 weeks ago we were doing like, you know, matam, what happened? You know? And what had happened was he had started listening to some right-wing material that was being put out on YouTube. And he heard it so much. And he came to me and I said, you know that Muhammad person, I think he was lying to us. Na'udhu billah, nastaghfirullah, right? And so I started asking him, like, okay, so have you spoken to a scholar? Have you thought about this? Have you thought about that? And he said, no, I haven't. Right? So number two, asking questions is very important. Number three, as Sheikh Amin mentioned, going for courses. The reason why courses are important, let me put it to you in this way. Like, you know, let's say if you build a house, and you put the walls and the ceilings and the roof and the structure into place. When the structure is into place, if somebody gives you a sofa, you know where to put it, right? If somebody gives you, for example, a table, you know which room it goes into because the structure is in place. That's the same relationship between a course and a majlis. When you go for a course, it's giving you the framework and the structure, yeah? And there are many ways, of course, to acquire that. Then when you sit in a majlis and somebody gives you data or information, you know exactly where to place that in your system of beliefs. So having that framework is very, very important. The last thing I should mention though is, alhamdulillah, we're blessed to have so many opportunities to go online and to have courses. But that does not replace the need to be connected to a scholar locally. Right? To actually spend time with a scholar. To be connected to somebody, you know, who is vested with knowledge, right? And not only to be connected to them, because, look, one part of understanding the religion is ma'rifah, understanding. That's not going to bring about yaqeen by itself. And that's something we really need to understand. You know, just because I've understood something in my mind, it doesn't mean it's become a part of my heart. That requires a lot of work and effort and action and lifestyle until that yaqeen comes about. And then the role of that scholar is not only to teach me, but also to train me as well. And those are some things we might want to keep in mind, inshallah. Where's the moderator? Yeah. I think you might need a chair here, Brother Azhar. You got to moderate. You got to decide what questions we take. We only have one mic, all right.
Or does not appeal to their values. And then, of course, we cannot just how do we maneuver from that? How do we move forward from that? Is my question. So any guidance on that for the youth today?
So I think firstly we have to know what is culture and what is religion, and we have to be sure ourselves that something is a part of culture or something is a part of religion, right? And in order to understand that difference, we ourselves have to be somewhat knowledgeable about the religion or talk to somebody who is knowledgeable about the religion to say, okay, that's a cultural aspect and this is the religious aspect. The second thing is, not every cultural aspect is wrong. Religion does make room for culture. Yeah? As long as culture does not clash with the values and the beliefs of a religion, Islam has been okay. Culture has a place in our society. Culture defines a lot of the things that we do. Islam did not come to take culture away. إن خلقناكم من ذكر وأنثى وجعلناكم we have put you شعوبا وقبائل لتعارفوا, right? And therefore you find that in the history of Islam, you know, Islam came to Arabian culture, it came to Iranian culture, it came to Indo-Pak culture as well, and went to other cultures. And yes, it did take some shape of that culture where it's allowed to. So things like, for example, celebrations, you know, religion doesn't tell you in the detail of how to celebrate. Some of it is cultural, or even commemoration. Some of it is cultural, for example, the way we commemorate the Azza of Imam al-Hussein, and that's okay. There is ajr and there is thawab in there. So just because something is cultural doesn't always mean that it is against the teachings of the religion, and we need to, yeah, maybe there's a culture change happening, and we need to be able to manage that, right? The third thing is, let's say you came across something where, okay, that's a cultural belief, that's a cultural practice, and actually it's not there in Islam, right? I've always believed in my work that I've done in the community is very rare cases where you have to confront people. You've got to be able to work with people. You've got to be able to bring about a slow cultural change and understanding, for example. Need to be able to have conversations about it. Sometimes you need scholars to come in and talk about it and address it, for example, right? And not push it, right? Because we don't want to break the relationship that we have with the elders. We don't want to break the respect that we should have of the elders. You know, sometimes I don't think we recognize the role that an elder plays in a community. I remember this hadith, I can't forget the hadith, you know? الشيخ في عشيرته كالنبي في أمته. Like an elderly person in his عشيرة, like his tribe, his family, is like a Nabi in his community. That's the role, some of the roles of, you know, a Nabi that he plays over there, right? In terms of giving hope and helping people. So taking it on or confronting it sometimes is not the way to take it. We need to raise awareness, we need to talk about it, and slowly bring about change in those areas.
I gave you the hard ones, okay? All right, there's a lot of questions here, so I'm going to try to race through some of them, and then once I lose my breath, I'll give it to Sheikh for his. Salam, I was wondering why Allah created 12 imams in particular. If he had done 14, he would have said, why was it 14? Yeah? Certain things that, you know, Allah has knowledge of. Yes, there are deeper hadiths maybe about this number 12, about why, I don't remember them. I don't know if Mulana remembers anything right now. But the most important thing is that there were 12, we'll follow those 12. If there were 13, we'll follow 13. And that's all I can say right now. So there are some things we're not 100% sure about. There was an alim, he would always answer like that. He would say, why are there like panjatan? He said if it was 6, he would say, why is there 6? Why are there 12 imams? Well, because if there was 10, you would say, why are there 10? The point he was trying to make, though, was that, this is a number that's in Allah's hands, and he chose it like that. We're not 100% sure. Don't give me a question without me reading it before. I don't know. As I'm talking, a question comes, and I look at it. All right, we'll get to that one. All right, next. This is a sister, probably, with good handwriting. Sometimes when I have a problem and I need to find a solution to something, I ask my close family and friends for help. Is it considered ghiba if I explain the whole situation to my close ones in order to obtain help? But this changes the perspective of someone whom I'm talking about. So you said, is it ghibat? Yeah, it might be ghibat, but is it haram or not? That's the real question. There are some forms of ghibat that are haram, some forms of ghibat that are jayiz, some are even wajib sometimes. All right, so before I explain those, you guys, with the salawat, if we can have you guys move forward a little bit. Recite the salawat. Oh, that's good. All right, so ghibat has different categories. Some are jayiz, some are wajib, some are haram. Usually the one that you and I want to tell people is the haram version. Okay, let's get that straight first. Okay? Sometimes it's ghibat is wajib. Why? You have to tell somebody else the flaws of somebody because they're about to get themselves killed, for example. They're about to get themselves in deep trouble, for example. They've come to you like... they're getting your, consulting you regarding getting married, and you know this dude's a drug addict, unfortunately, right? But he's hiding it. Well, it's telling somebody else the flaws of a third person, and that is the definition of ghibat. But it's a jayiz, sometimes wajib ghibat. You get what I'm saying? So yeah, if you are in a situation where you really feel like you need to explain and get the right answer because you need the help, you have to give the whole story, then it's fine. Yeah. Okay. But please, this should not be abused. Yeah, the other night in the other center that I'm in, I said this. Some people, they make ghibat wajib for themselves. How? How? The guy says, like, if I don't tell people this thing, I'll die. And it is wajib to protect the protect yourself from death. So I'm going to tell people. Tells one person, feels like they're still going to die. So you got to tell the second person. 5 people, 10 people, then they can take a breath of fresh air. How much makeup can a woman wear in front of non-mahram? Well, according to Al Sistani and Al Khamni, anything that's zinat. Yeah? Zinat is a form of beautification, enhancement, things like that. If it's zinat, and falls in that category, and you have this word in Urdu. We have it in Farsi too, and in Arabic too. So we all know what this word means, right? To decorate, to adorn, to beautify, to enhance, and all these things. If it's zinat and falls into the category of zinat, Al-Sistani Al-Khamni say completely, in front of non-mahram, it has to be covered. Yeah. So is it haram to wear makeup? No. It's haram for non-mahram to see it, if it's zinat. Okay? Some people ask about, I don't want to get into details. The question hasn't gotten into details, so I'm not going to get into any more details about that. First off, thank you both for taking the time out to be here. Thank you. Good feedback. Thank you. Yeah, I'm not even going to read the rest of the question. That's good. My question is, I'm just going very quickly. My question, what are the requirements for someone to go to Qom for Islamic studies? Usually there are no requirements in that sense. You go, usually nowadays, the earliest that you'll go is probably after your diploma, high school diploma. Yeah, so it's not like there's a list of requirements you have to meet, Now when you go there will be interviews, there might be some, little tests they might have to see where you're at, regarding just normal, basic Islamic knowledge. So they'll ask you so what do you think about music? If you're like, yeah, I want to be a rapper when I grow up, they're going to probably send you back to Toronto. Yeah, but it's very basic stuff, really. And so, what kind of prior knowledge do you need? Know your name, know your address, these kinds of things when you go. Right? When you're filling out the form, really, it's nothing really crazy, really. Because you're going to Hawza to learn, right? There's no Ayatollah goes and says, I want to sign up for Hawza. They'll say, you can teach us. We don't need to have you enter Hawza. No, just the basics. Sometimes it might be better for them to see that, yeah, you know something a little bit about just the basics of namaz and roza and stuff like that, really. That, so you're not a liability in the future, maybe all of a sudden this person went down the wrong path or something like that, which usually isn't the case, or else they wouldn't have gone to Hawza anyway. Do they start from scratch? So yeah, kind of, yes. Thank you. This is a very kind person. It's probably one of the sisters. I know the guys here. And... All right, so I'll hand the mic to you, and then after a few, or do you want me to hand it to you?
Okay, how can 30, 40-year-old professionals and entrepreneurs give back to the community and help the youth guide them through their academic, Islamic, and professional paths? First thing I've got to say is that, you know, no matter what profession we're in, we have to feel a sense of duty and responsibility to the community. And whatever is required in the community, we should be willing to do. Not picking and choosing and saying, you know, this is what I'd like to do, or this is the thing that, you know. I'm always sort of moved by a story about Shahid Mutahhari, how he was driven by a sense of duty. Whatever is required, if they need a volunteer to stand outside and, for example, to move the traffic, doesn't matter. Even if I am wherever I am in my company, I do that. You know, he published a very philosophical book, Usul al-Falsafeva Ravisheri al-Ism. It's like a thick book like this, and not an easy read. Very, very difficult read over there. He was actually commenting on a book written by Allama Tabatabai. Yeah. And people who doubted him in his capacity, actually when they saw that book, they said, oh, we were wrong in telling you not to go to the Hawza. And, you know, mashallah, you have the capacity to really understand this material. So they announced that he has come out with another book. And everybody's waiting for this book, like, okay, Falsafe Part 2. You know what he came out with? Dastan-e Rastan, a storybook. A storybook for kids, because he realized that, you know what, people also need good role models. So whatever, you know, is required is what we do. The second thing is, I know we would like to guide the youth in the community, but the first thing I think is required is actually having a relationship with the youth in the community. Now, to actually show them that I do care for you, I want to spend time with you. It's not, okay, I'm coming to tell you what you need to do now, get your life in order, right? Spend some time with the youth in the community. That's your capital. You know, it takes a lot of time to build a relationship of trust. It takes a lot of time to build a relationship of love. And when that trust is built, the conversations are much easier. But if we just want to go in there and say, hey, I'm going to talk to you and we're going to fix you up now, it's not going to work, really. So we have to do that. And sometimes you come to the masjid and you see a young man sitting in the corner. You know, we were talking about this yesterday at some place. We want to go and do tabligh and bring other people into the faith, for example, when we have, you know, for every one person who comes in, three people are leaving, for example, right? But, or we want to do something big. How can we get to so many people? You know, how can we actually get Islam to the masses? Islam actually worked one-to-one, person-to-person. Right? Don't you see Imam al-Hussein on his way to Karbala? How many times? I just have narrated some stories for you. But he would call one person and say, I want to talk to you, one person. And he would spend 1 or 2 hours talking to that one person, for example. Because in Islam, it's not about, okay, how many people, but one person. We see a young person in the community sitting alone by themselves or having some struggles. Okay, that is my wazifa. I work with that one person. The Prophet of Allah says to Imam Ali, if God were to guide through you one person, it is better than whatever the sun shines upon. Right? So I think that's you know, some ways for us to work with that. What are rituals and what do you mean by a broader religion? So, you know, our religion is generally made up of three parts. There are the aqidah, the beliefs of the faith. There is the akhlaq, the values, the morals and the ethics of the faith. And then there is the ahkam, the laws and the practices of the faith. And rituals fall under the laws and practices of the faith. Now, these rituals, some of them are religious rituals like prayer and fasting. Some of the rituals are more commemorations, and some of them have a more cultural, for example, aspect to it, like some of the commemorations that we do for Muharram. And some of the commemorations are religious commemorations, like crying for Imam al-Hussein, like gathering, like going for ziyarah. And generally, a ritual is something that you do repetitively, and you do over and over again, okay? What are rituals and what do we mean by a broader religion? So rituals are like prayer and fasting and things of that manner. The point I was trying to make is that the problem is not that we have focused on rituals. The reason why we focus on rituals is because the Ahlul Bayt have also focused on that. The Ahlul Bayt have also taught us the ahkam of the deen, right? The fifth or the sixth Imam says, if I found a young man from the Shia who doesn't know the ahkam of the deen, should I say the rest of the hadith or maybe not? Okay, maybe not. Yeah. Say the rest of the hadith, yeah. I'm going to put it in a light way. Don't be surprised if I disciplined him. But discipline is not like, hey, don't do that again. Yeah. Discipline is proper discipline, yeah? All right. yeah, don't be surprised if I did that. That's not the problem. The problem is that as we focus on the rituals, we also have to focus on the other mafahim of the deen as well. It's got to match that. The akhlaq of the religion, right? The ahkam, the aqaid of the religion as well. And the broader meaning of religion is deen, it is a way of life. I'm taking a lot more time answering the questions. I hope you're okay with that. I'm not going to finish. That is true. That is true. All right. This one should be an interesting one. Then I'll do this one. I'll pass it back to you. So what should we do if we are confronted by a racist who's asking us to prove and provide facts to prove that Islam isn't a fascist religion? Discipline him. Ahsant. Yeah. The first thing I want to point out is the problem is with the racist himself. And I don't think in every case we have to try and explain and justify ourselves. You know, it's making an assumption that there is something wrong in the religion of Islam. No, no. The problem is with the racist. And the problem is with his thinking. And the problem is with the intolerance that he has in his mind. That is what needs to be fixed. We spend too much time trying to explain ourselves. And we don't have to do that, right? So you explain this part of the religion. Tomorrow, because he's a racist, he's got an issue with that part of the religion. Now you explain that part of the religion. Because he's racist, he's got a problem with this person and that person. How long does that go on? We've got to call out racists for being racist and say, the problem is not my religion, the problem is your thinking and your intolerance. Well, number two, if it's out of ignorance, we remove some of the misconceptions that they have. People have been given the wrong information about Islam. We do our duty to explain it to them. But if it's out of hatred, if it's out of, for example, wanting to harm the Muslim community, well, then we report that person. And we take the legal avenue that is available to us. We don't shy away from that. The last point over here is we shouldn't just be people who are on the defensive. Okay? How long are we going to be on the defensive, trying to defend our religion? We should call things out as well, right? Somebody comes and tells us, I say, well, you know, you don't have a great history being Canadians either. Canada doesn't have a great history either. And we got to know the facts. The way First Nations were treated, it's called cultural genocide, right? The way the Japanese were treated in the Second World War, put into camps, concentration camps in BC, that's documented. It's not a great history there either. So, I mean, when things are being pointed out about Islam, you know, we also have to point out that, look, you know, don't just be pointing fingers at one particular group of people. We also sometimes have to go on the offensive. All right.
All right. How should you respond to a person that swears at your religion, family, and Allah? I think he clarified. Sometimes you just have to just keep going, you know, don't even stop. I mean, things are getting scary a little bit. And sometimes when you respond, the guy has issues. The guy has issues at home. The guy has issues outside. And he's taking it out on you. It really depends on the case. On every case is different. Sometimes you have to sit down and explain things to them. Sometimes you give him $5, he's all of a sudden he's in love with you. Yeah. I mean, that happened during the Imam's times too. The guy would come and start speaking ill of the Imam back and forth. And the Imam's like, after he lets him unload and just get everything off his chest, he's like, hey, you're new to this city. Is there anything I could help you with? Before you know it, the guy's in love with the Imam. So the guy had other issues, right? So each case is different, really. Sometimes you just have to put your head down and move on. People be dumb these days. Here. Who currently in our world has direct communication to Imam Mahdi? It ain't me, I know that. Mulana? Azhar? They laugh the most at your name. Yeah, me and Azhar go back to many years ago. Don't worry about these things, brothers and sisters. These things, if they were supposed to be known by us, then Allah would tell us, go research this, go find out this. But what really matters is, how much am I ready? How much am I obeying Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? If my death was to arrive tomorrow, that's the real thing that we need to ask. who sees, who doesn't see. There's a lot of talk about these things. And unfortunately, some people have opened up shop as well when it comes to these things, okay? When you speak to ulama, real ulama, proper ulama, they're not discussing these matters of, let's find out who's in touch with Imam right now, who's not in touch with Imam right now. Do non-believers go to hell even if their akhlaq are superior to a Muslim? There's a lot to say about this. If someone's non-Muslim or is not on the straight path because it's their fault that they're not on the straight path, then it doesn't matter how good their akhlaq is. But a lot of the people out there today who are non-Muslim but have good akhlaq, the reason why they're not Muslim is not because they turned away from the truth knowing that it's the truth, right? Lots of times, I mean, we all have friends, right, in the non-Muslim world out there that we have non-Muslim friends who believe that Christianity is what God wants from them, right? People like Allama Tabatabai have written in their books that if that person is convinced that this is what God wants from me, that like Jesus is Lord or something, then we can't necessarily say, oh, he's going to go to hell. So this idea of every non-Muslim goes to hell, every Muslim goes to heaven, it's not necessarily the case. And who says every non-Muslim doesn't make it? The only reason why I have the courage to say this right now is because people like Allama Tabatabai have said it in their books. Like there's a book called Risalatul Wilayah over there. He explains this. That in the end, it goes back to how much accountability I have. Yeah, if there was a 10% chance for me that Islam is the right path, I just said, you know what, forget it, let's just play Xbox. And then yeah, then I'm going to be held, then I can be held responsible. But if 100% I'm sure that this is the path that God wants from me, doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to go to hell just because they're non-Muslim. Why did Allah put mubah? Because if he didn't, you say, why didn't you put mubah? You know, you see a pattern here? Lots of the answers are easy. No, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is not going to put not everything is mustahab, makruh, wajib or haram out there. There's a lot of things like walking from here to there. Okay, what is Allah going to say? That's mustahab? No. Yes, if you're walking to the masjid, you're walking to the majlis, yeah, every step you take probably is mustahab as well. But there's a lot of things out there that are just normal life things. God says, okay, these are normal life things. There's no rule here. So it's mubah. It's, you can do it, you cannot do it, no problem at all.
What are steps we as Muslims should take when talking to the opposite gender? How do we know what they value when we cannot talk to them? All right. It's a very interesting question. I'll say something on the side, not related to this question, is whenever a young person, you know, brother comes to me and says, you know, Hulana, I have a sister who's interested in Islam. I know what the story behind that is. Yeah? We kind of know what the story there is. But put that aside, one thing is ought to be clear that in Islam, you know, brothers and sisters who are not related to each other, who are not mahram to each other, they do have a very separate relationship. You know, they, as brothers and brothers do, or sisters and sisters do, you know, brothers and brothers be friends with each other, hang out with each other, rub shoulders with each other, you, time of difficulty, whatever it is, you kind of, you know, ask each other for some support. But in Islam, brothers and sisters, no mahram to each other, they do not have that kind of a relationship, period. Now, that doesn't mean that, for example, they don't talk to each other at all. Sometimes in a professional environment or at the school or whatever it is, they need to be able to have a conversation there. I say two things should be kept in mind. Firstly, the conversation should be a purposeful conversation, right? And we stick to the purpose. Whatever the professional need is, whatever the research is, we do that particular research. You know, you would want to read about the story of Prophet Musa when he sees the daughters of Shu'aib. Right? So, I mean, if you read the verses of the Quran, he doesn't chat them up and say, how's the weather today? And, you know, what else did you do today? No. You know, ma khatbukuma. Like, why are you here? They said, we're here because we are wanting to feed our animals. And wa abuna shaykhun kabir. Father is elderly, that's why he cannot come. So he just gave them the water and he went away. Purposeful, right? The second thing is respectful as well. Right? So not telling jokes, not, for example, you know, trying to impress anybody. No, very respectful conversation over there. You know, one day the sixth imam saw one of his companions got really upset at him. And he said, why are you upset at me? He said, today it seems like instead of teaching Quran to that lady, you are telling jokes to her. Right? So no, very respectful conversation. Talked about duty and responsibility towards ahkam and towards justice. We see stress on ahkam and rituals, and sometimes that seems to drive the youth away. What's your advice to our ritualistic centers? Right? Because we have so much rituals, it drives the youth away. Am I allowed to get in a little bit of trouble now? Yeah, that's okay. All right. We do have sometimes a lot of rituals in our centers. And we got to be careful about that. We shouldn't overdo the rituals, especially when we are in jama'ah. Right? In jama'ah, it was supposed to be just the basic of the jama'ah. I'll give you an example, right? So we get an idea of what we're talking about here. So today, for example, let's say somebody came, and I'm talking about my own masjid there where I am present. And that's what happens there. That's what I'm talking about. I am, you know, whatever happens in other masajid, that's not, I'm not commenting on that. If somebody comes from Maghrib and Isha prayer, so first we have the adhan, then we have the iqama, of course, we have the salat itself. After the salat, we have three takbir, we have three salawat, then we have what? Three istighfar, then we have tasbih, then we have what? Then we have the dua itself, then we have the next salat. For the next salat, we have what? The same thing happening again. And then we have the ziyarah, and after ziyarah, we have the shaking of the hands. And after the shaking of the hands, we also have a dua for those who are sick and those who are suffering and also, and everything. I'm just thinking at the time of the Prophet, how was it? The young man came to the mosque, he heard the iqama, he came to masjid, he said Maghrib Salat with the Holy Prophet, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, pin drop silence. Whoever wanted to stay to do his salawat, tasbih, did it themselves, didn't want to do it, didn't do it. Right? Left the masjid. In the same way, in the month of Muharram, we have a lot of programs and we should have in people's homes. But then when we start having at everybody's homes, 3-5 marthiya and the lecture, and then 4-5 noha, and then this and that, and the next person's home, and the next person's home, and the next person's home, it becomes a bit difficult there. So we need to think about that a little bit. How? Well, we can talk about that, but we need to think about that, number one. Number two, but those rituals that we're supposed to do, those are important. Religion doesn't grow without rituals, you know. For example, a person is wanting to work out and they want to develop some muscles. Well, it's not going to happen by doing it once a month. Every day, you got to stick to a diet, you got to stick to a workout regime, you got to stick to a particular lifestyle, and then you get those muscles, right? In the same way, well, spirituality is no different. Yeah, Sheikh Amin? It seems like you got experience there. Yeah, all right, Ahsant. And in any case, that's there is a lot to say there. All right, I'll end with this one. I'll pass it on to you before I get myself into too much trouble. There's a big UFC fight, Khabib, at 2 p.m. tomorrow. I really want to watch it. Is that immoral? Okay, is that haram or immoral? What's your fatwa on that one?
You already got yourself in trouble. Just finish it off.
Just finish it off? Okay. They just want to watch a fight on TV. Yes. Can I? Is it related to this question or my previous comments? Yes, my original comments. All right. Yes.
As a father, when my children start, what I'm worried about is my children starting to follow certain elements.
You're the superstar.
You skipped the UFC one.
We'll come to that.
All right, so I hate to say it like this, but yeah, if you want to take down a superstar, you have to have another superstar to take them down. And so I know where you're coming from, brother. It's something that I really have on my chest as well. Now, you wish they were superstars, but at least they had studied enough, you know? Once again, you find that, no, the study, the credentials are lacking over there. So the only thing that comes to my mind, really, what is the reason why the kids want to go in that direction is because that person is pretty cool. And so we have to try to, and that's one important thing about people going from the West to Hausa sometimes, is that they can go study, come back and be as cool as well, because they've grown up in this culture. Okay? Now, back in the day, 5, 6, 7 years ago, when I was coming here more often, we were always playing volleyball in the back with the guys. Right? All of you guys now, I'm seeing you're all grown up, right? We spent time together. And so, personally, I could tell that, okay, the fact that I can play volleyball with these guys and beat their backs and play basketball with them, except for this guy right here, this big one right here dunking on us, the rest, they weren't so good. And so they look up to you. Yeah, they connect with you. This is something my dad told me maybe 25 years ago. He's like, son, come, let's have a talk. So of course I rolled my eyes, I went and sat down. He's like, son, beta, let me tell you something. I think you growing up here, knowing the language here, the culture here, the sports, you know, all that stuff, can really help you if you go and learn in Hausa. I'm like, what's Hausa? I don't even know what's going on. Go and learn and come back, you can help the communities out. He's a smart guy. His ideas are good, executing them are pretty hard though. And so, now I'm seeing it. That yeah, people, now I've gotten old, now I'm slow and I'm 37 years old now, I can't do much anymore. Yeah? Now I need people that come after who can also do that. And I'm seeing them, they're out there, they're in Qom right now, some of them, that can come back and also be cool in a way. Be in a way that kids can relate to them. That's the only way the bonding can happen. There has to be some form of bonding, or else, yeah, the other side is very flashy sometimes. Yeah, you said the right, you used the right word. Some call them the, forgot the other name people use, which is expressive of what they have, the flashy stuff. Yeah, so I can't think of any other way really, because it is appealing. What they have also, some of these brothers out there probably have good intentions, but their ways are kind of wrong in my opinion. What they have is that what that kid can connect to. Nowadays, for me, lots of places I go, kids aren't even interested in sports anymore. You know what I'm saying? Now you go to the West Coast, California, salam guys, I'm here, I can ball. They're like, ow, my nails might break. I'm not interested in playing basketball. Where are you, Murali? Where are you, Murali? Oh, there you are. Yeah. The guy wants to play on video games. I don't know how to play video games anymore. Back then it was NBA Jam or something we used to play. He's on fire, remember that? I'm getting very old. I'm talking too much. So yeah, that's the only thing that comes to my mind, brother, really. Is that to counter it, you have to have the same thing. Yeah? But you have to be a different person. And hopefully in the future there's more and more of that as well. Can we watch the fight?
The fight between two superstars? Muslim is, so it must be mustahab or wajib. Yeah. I just want to point out one thing over here is, okay, so the question whether it is halal or haram, I mean, I don't think any marja saying is haram or, you know, I don't think it's an issue of halal and haram, and there's no fatwa to that effect over there. But what I do want us to think about is a question that came earlier about the issue of mubah. Why is there mubah? You know, and sometimes we have to, as I said earlier, think ourselves as moral human beings and be driven by the akhlaq of Islam, be driven by morality. It shouldn't be that everything, every detail of how we're supposed to live needs to be pointed out to us. Sometimes we need to think, what is our duty and responsibility? What does Islam want me to do? The way I think of ahkam, I think of them as the boundaries. Islam is saying, don't go beyond these boundaries. All right? It doesn't mean I want to sit at the boundary. What do I mean by that? I mean that, okay, just because something isn't wajib doesn't mean I don't want to think for myself and say, should I make that mandatory upon me? Just because something isn't haram doesn't mean that I shouldn't talk to myself and say, is that something that, you know, for my own ethical and spiritual growth, I should stay away from it? Like, do I need a fatwa that tells me you should recycle? A human being should think about it. Now, there's one example that really stands out to me from the life of the second Imam. Imam al-Hasan al-Mujtaba alayhi afdal al-salati wa salam. There was a dog in front of him. The dog was hungry. The Imam was feeding the dog with his own hands. The food that he had, he was giving to the dog. Somebody came there and said, Yabna Rasulillah, this is not worthy of your status. You shouldn't be doing that. Somebody else can do it, right? The response the Imam gave was not that, look, this is wajib or mustahab or... No. The Imam said something. He said that, I feel haya, astahi. Okay? From seeing a being with a soul hungry and I would have food with me and I wouldn't give it to that being. We should have that kind of a sense of responsibility within us. So just because something is mubah doesn't mean now I close my mind and I say, okay, it's not haram, it's not wajib, I don't have to think about it anymore. No, right? Now when it comes to fight, I mean, you know, probably there isn't an issue with it. But every time we consume the media, we need to be smart consumers of the media. I watched something, right? What was the message that came from it? What impact did it have upon my heart? Do I understand what impact it had upon my heart, for example? What happens when I watch it over and over again? Maybe you think about it and nothing happens, okay. Or maybe you think about it and say, no. That, when I'm watching it, I'm noticing this particular movie or serial or whatever it is, when I'm watching it, I'm noticing it's bringing about this value within me. Okay, maybe the fatwa doesn't say it's haram, but I say, okay, maybe that's something I'd like to stay away from. Brother, just also if Sheikh Amin would allow me to answer your question as well. I think it also comes down to how we raise our children, right? If we raise our children to always want entertainment, to want excitement, and we raise them in that culture, it's very hard to keep them away from that kind of a circuit. Right? We can try our best to tell them that, Baba, this is not the person we want to listen to. They have grown up in a culture of entertainment, a culture of excitement, a culture of instant gratification, a culture of glitter. It is normal that they will go down that path. I think it's important that we raise them with good tarbiyah first. The second thing as well, is there are certain things we will not be able to control in life. They are going to be like that. Yeah? There's no way that's going to go away. That's there, and probably more of that is going to come. Like many other things in life, right? Then what we have to do is not just go to my child and say, this and that. Yeah, I talked about this and that. But I should be able to give them the standards, the mi'yar, of what is a good scholar, who should we listen to. I mean, what should you even expect when you're listening to a scholar? Right? And number three, we should introduce them to good scholars from a very young age. You know, somebody who's loving, somebody who's caring. My teacher, he says that I met Shaheed As-Sadr when I was 13 and he was a marja of taqlid in Najaf. And he said the way Shaheed As-Sadr talked to me, it's as if I was the most important person he was talking to. How are your parents, your family? I know this person from your family. It left an impact on him that he remembered it, you know, right now when he was teaching me. We introduce them to good scholars. Not just telling them, stay away. No, introduce them. Once they see the value of a good scholar who not only does ta'aleem, but does tarbiyah as well, then I find naturally when they listen to that kind of a speech, it just doesn't work for them, right? I think those are some fundamental things that inshallah we can try to do.
Okay, certain hadith say that if you do certain du'as and a'mal, it is wajib for you to get sent to heaven. What happens if you do the worst of the worst sins, yet do these amals? You probably go to hell. It's wrong to think that a dua is going to do the job. Okay? These ideas and notions go against the Quran and everything the Quran is shouting out to us. Okay? Yeah. If it says that if you do this, it'll be wajib for you to get Jannah, that means if you've taken care of, you know, your duties as a Muslim, and now you've supplemented it with this dua, for example. Yeah. Never ever think that there's a shortcut, brothers and sisters. There is no shortcut. Till the grave, we have to be obedient. of Allah. And if we mess up, we say, Allah, I'm sorry, I'll try my best not to repeat it. Get back up on my feet if I mess up. That's simple. Easier said than done, though. Easier said than done. That's all that matters, brothers and sisters. And when I'm telling you this, is things that we've heard from the greats. I'm not saying it just out of my own whim. Salam, how can we deal with anxiety in an Islamic/spiritual way? Yeah, sometimes anxiety might have its roots in spiritual issues. But I'll just share with you this story that I saw firsthand myself. I was sitting there with in the presence of one of these great, great ulama that everyone knew how great he was. It was a gathering like this, but I was like sitting up front, and I saw, like, you see, he has like, sometimes he has these special du'as for something he writes. Yeah, one of the students of Allama Tabatabai. But when he got this question, anxiety, depression, you know what he said? He said, go get professional help. Like, I know you write du'as and stuff, write me something. No. He said, go get professional help and make sure you, and he said this too, make sure you take the medication they give you. Because apparently he knows that lots of people don't take that medication. Yeah. So that's also something.